In a Sunday meeting, he came into the program in 2007 and found lasting sobriety in 2009. I'd like to introduce Chad T.
I am Chad. I am a sexaholic. I've been sober since July 15th, 2009. I am very grateful to be here tonight. I want to thank all the organizers for putting on this conference. I know it takes a lot of hard work and time, and very grateful you did that. I went to a Unity conference like this early on in my recovery with my wife in Asheville, North Carolina, and it was really important in my journey of recovery. So I feel these conferences are super important. So the theme for this weekend, happy, joyous, and free, I didn't think any three of those were ever possible in my life. I didn't think I deserved happiness. If life was going well, I actually felt uneasy, like off kilter, kind of waiting for like that feeling to go away. And I don't know why, kind of waiting for that next shoe to drop. At my first few SA meetings, people were smiling, even laughing, and it drove me absolutely crazy because I could not understand, because I felt like crap, and I could not understand why people could be smiling and at an SA meeting. I really resented those guys. But first, let me explain a little about how I got here. I had a pretty good family environment growing up, but it was a very religious household. My mother was a minister. We went to church every day. The doors were open, and I was not a big fan of this. And there were a lot of great people at that church, so I think we're genuinely trying to help me, but I just didn't realize it at the time. But in my warped mind, I took away several poor conclusions from that time in my life. One, at church, there was a lot of fire and brimstone, kind of like, if you don't do these things, you are going straight to hell. And it came away with this idea, this image of God at this very mean and scary dude, and I really wanted nothing to do with him. And then second, I saw a lot of people down on their knees praying all the time, asking for help. And I felt this was weak and pretty silly. I didn't understand it. And I said, okay, that's not for me. I was going to get up. I'm smart. I can solve my own problems. I'm going to figure this out. You know, I'm out of here. I'll play God, which I liked in your share when you talked about the more I play God, the worse it gets. We'll get to that in a little bit. And then finally, at church and in my family, you never, ever talked about sex. That was the forbidden topic. You never went there. You didn't share feelings, thoughts, questions. You just kept that to yourself. So you can see where that was going to go. So like most kids, I encountered pornography, you know, in my friend group growing up. I'm old, so it was magazines and photos and eventually videos. But those images opened up a whole new world for me, a world of fantasy and an escape from reality. I later tried alcohol, I dabbled in drugs, but nothing could ever replace what lust could do for me. That was my drug of choice, and I don't know why, and I don't really need to figure out why, it just is. I am a sexaholic. And I vividly recall stealing a check from my mother's wallet to order my first pornography tape. And more than anything, looking back, it was the thrill of getting it and nobody finding out. And I think so much of my addiction was more the pursuit of lust, chasing it. When I actually would get it, it would often be a letdown. But it was just that chase. That's often what gave me that adrenaline rush. But even back then as a kid, I could see that my friends could kind of move on. But I always wanted to linger on those images a little longer. And that eventually spilled into my relationships. I wasn't interested in getting to know you. I wasn't interested in a friendship. Certainly wasn't interested in intimacy. I certainly didn't even know what that was. I just wanted sex. and I would tell people whatever they needed to hear to get what I needed. I was a fake, a fraud, and a liar over and over and over again. It was all just putting on an act. And so as a consequence, I destroyed friendships, probably really good ones. I cheated on girlfriends, and I could be a fairly honorable person in many areas of my life, but in this area, my moral compass was completely broken early on. So for instance, in order to rent X-rated movies at the local video store, I would write down my best friend's name on the little login sheet that you had to sign. So I subjected him to shame and trouble, all sorts of things. Now, who does that to their best friend? I do. So in college, I met my first wife, but when we were engaged, I cheated on her with someone I worked with. And I did this openly in front of my roommates, putting them in an incredibly awkward spot. But again, I didn't care about anyone except for myself. So we got married way too young, but I thought, okay, this is great. I'm married, I got a beautiful wife, I won't need all this pornography and masturbation anymore. But I still needed more. And I recall driving down the road one night to an empty parking lot to go act out in my car alone. And I remember thinking, this is a little odd. I have a wife at home. Why isn't she enough? But not surprisingly, that relationship did not last, and she left me. She actually had the courage to leave. I never would have had the courage to leave. And so I was divorced at 22, and I sank into a deep, dark pit of despair. And I medicated it with a ton of lust. I spent money I did not have, racking up huge cable TV bills, ordering movies. But unbeknownst to me, my higher power is looking out for me and sent me my current wife. Again, I thought maybe this will save me. I would binge and purge pornography over and over, and I knew what I was doing was toxic. I felt shame about it, and so I would throw it all away. And then I would accumulate it all over again, over and over and over again, same pattern. So one day, my wife found my stash of pornography in an old microwave in the closet. Really clever place to put it. So she brought out, you know, my big trash bag of nasty things, and she confronted me. And that was the first time I remember seeing that I was hurting somebody else from my addiction. Because I just figured, this is a victimless crime. I don't really care if I hurt myself. But she was hurt, and she was saying, you know, why am I not enough? Why do you need this stuff? And I didn't really have a good answer, but I vowed I want to throw it all away, and I did. But then I got it all back in a couple weeks. I was also giving up enormous amounts of time to my disease. I would stay up all night, chasing images, looking things up, and then I'd wake up cranky the next day and take it out on everyone around me. But then I started to cross other lines that I said, oh, I'll never, ever do that. But my disease needed more. I wanted more. So I started cheating on my wife and having sex with prostitutes. This is also the time my wife was pregnant and having my two daughters. I lived in fear of getting a disease and passing it on to my wife and unborn child. I kept waiting for the day when the doctor would pull me aside in the doctor's office and say, Chad, we know what you've been doing. I replayed that over and over. And a reasonable person at that point would have stopped, but I did not, because I am insane, and I kept acting out recklessly. I was almost arrested one time. I would leave work in the middle of the day, got caught in a sting operation, cops got me, guns drawn, pointed right at my head. But they didn't really care about me. They asked me a few questions, they let me go. But I realized then I should have been arrested, I should have lost my job, should have lost my marriage, and lost my family. I swore, I will never do that again. I probably even prayed to God, which I never did. But it wasn't much of a prayer because I didn't really believe it. And 2 weeks later, I was right back at it. I couldn't stop, and I never would on my own. During all this, I told myself plenty of lies to justify it. My life is so stressful at work and at home with young kids. I deserve this, or I just need it to get through the day. Life is so hard. But I was still miserable. I hated myself for what I was doing and the double life I was living. I didn't even really like the acting out those last few years. I didn't like the people I was around. I didn't like the places I was going. But I still went inside every single time. I would literally be shaking in my car. Every fiber of my body was saying, do not do it. But I always did. I couldn't stop. Lust had become my response to every imaginable human emotion. Happiness, anger, boredom, frustration. I was like this 12-year-old kid who had stopped growing emotionally and was just stuck there, and lust became my coping mechanism for everything. So finally we get to 1 December. My wife is putting up the Christmas tree with my sister, and she wants to find some photos of my kids. So she starts to go look. And finally she goes look in an old briefcase in the back of my car. And instead, she found the hotel receipts and other paperwork that made it apparent what I had been doing. And then had, I don't know how she did, waited a couple hours for my sister to leave. And then she confronted me later that night and threw me out of the house. And again, I had played that night in my head a zillion times. I knew it was going to happen. And I kept doing it over and over. And I will never forget the sound of her sobbing in the shower as I packed up, because no lie was going to save me that time. It was done. So next morning at my motel, my first thought was, I'm going to the gun shop, I'm going to buy a gun, and I'm going to kill myself. Because everyone's going to know the real Chad now. And what a scoundrel I am. No one, not even my family, will ever love me. I'm done, and it's time to check out. But my higher power had different plans. It was still scary sitting in a motel for 4 nights with a loaded gun. So each night I would call my wife before I would go out to do it. And I don't know why, but she picked up the phone. We would talk. I'd say, okay, I'll do it tomorrow. Then the next night I called. She'd pick up. I said, all right, I'll do it tomorrow. My higher power was buying me time, because eventually I told my wife, and she took the gun. And then we agreed to go see our pastor together the next morning. And he handed me a brochure about Sexaholics Anonymous. I had never, ever heard this word. But I immediately identified with it, because that's me. I agreed to attend a meeting, but let me be clear. I did not go to this meeting for the right reasons. I wanted to save my marriage. I wanted to keep my kids. And when I sat down in the meeting, all I did was look around to see how many people still had a wedding ring on. That was all I cared about. People were talking about, you know, sexual sobriety and recovery, and sex was indeed optional. This sounded like absolute nonsense to me. Impossible. Maybe for them, but not for me. I could not imagine going through a day without sex in some form. It was like they were talking in some foreign language. But luckily for me, I stuck around, and I kept going to meetings. The thing I did like right away was that I could show up and just be myself. I had never, ever been myself. I was like a total actor going through life. And it was just this relief that I could finally say the deepest, darkest secrets that I had never told a human soul on this planet. And these people were like, you know, they just nodded their heads like, whatever. They were not fazed. They were not impressed. They're like, you're not that special, Chad. But they accepted me and they offered their support. So I stuck around. But this was still surprising to me because I did not understand love. I was shocked that my own parents still loved me. They took me in for 7 months while I was separated from my wife. And I was shocked by this. I never thought unconditional love was possible. So early on, recovery was difficult, and I struggled to be honest. I did not tell my wife about all the money that I had stolen from our kids' college savings account to fund my addiction. I let her figure that out on her own. She didn't appreciate that. Even our pastor doubted me. He said, Chad, you must be a drug addict too. No one could spend this much money just on sex. Never underestimate a sexaholic. Then I dragged my feet on getting a sponsor. And my wife had the gall to get a sponsor in Essanon before I did. That really made me look bad. So I went and got a sponsor and started working the steps. And in some ways, it got worse than it got better. I finally had to deal with these events and emotions that I had buried for years. I had to take responsibility for my actions. I always imagined it was like prying open my rib cage and just everybody was getting to take free shots. I had to examine a lot of my old ideas about a higher power and how love actually works. And I had to draw up some new ideas and actually give them a try. Before, God was this very cold and distant figure who had abandoned me as a kid. The truth is, I had abandoned him. But in my old idea, he had this big universe to run and certainly no time for little old me. And that left an opening for me to play God and run my own life. But as was shared earlier, my analogy was always every time I took the wheel, I drove the bus into the ditch. So it was fairly easy to fire myself as God. But then I would get angry sometimes when people would go on and on about how great their higher power was and all these things that he had done. I said, well, where was this guy during my entire life? He never showed up for me. But I'm pretty stupid. So it took me a while to realize that my higher power had actually been there every single moment in my life. He did not like what I was doing. He probably had to shield his eyes many, many times. But he had spared me. He had protected me in those motels from violence and disease. He had spared my life numerous times. I don't know why, but he wasn't done with me yet. Most of all, he loved me no matter what. That's unconditional love. Learning to love myself took a lot longer. There was so much guilt and regret over how much I had hurt the people that I loved. But I had to believe I was worthy of recovery. So I took direction from my sponsor, and he told me I needed to come up with a surrender prayer to say each and every time I had a lustful thought. So I cobbled together a few words from the literature, and this is what I say. I surrender this lustful thought to you, Lord. Please relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will, not mine, be done. And I say that prayer over and over and over again. I would walk to a noontime meeting early in recovery, and I would say that prayer 35 times in five blocks. And it worked. It stops me in my tracks, gets me out of my head, and reminds me, in that moment, my higher power has something better in store for me from whatever stupid idea I have, and it's on me to figure that out. So early in recovery, I would go over to the house while we were separated. And one day my wife would be kind and caring. And then the next day she would hate my guts. So I would flee to the driveway, call my sponsor in a huff, be so mad. And I'd say, look, I didn't act out. I didn't do anything. I deserve a gold ribbon here. I'm working a great program. He would calmly respond, Chad, go read Acceptance was the answer in the back of the big book, page 417. I didn't like this advice. So 2 days later, the same thing would happen. I'd go to the driveway. I'd call him up. He'd say, Chad, go read Acceptance was the answer in the back of the big book. So finally I read it, that entire chapter, and it gave me a new way to view life, like a new pair of glasses, as the author writes. And a lot of the chapter is about the internal environment versus the external environment. And on page 14, it summed up my entire life and why I had struggled for so long. He wrote, if I could just control the external environment, the internal environment would then become comfortable. That was the old idea that never worked. I always imagined this neon sign over my head. If it just said, you know, leave me the hell alone, all would be great. But then he talks about his new idea in that chapter. By taking care of the internal environment via the 12 steps and letting the external environment take care of itself. And then he goes on, 417, I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world as on what needs to be changed in me and my attitudes. So I started to work on some new ideas. One was that everyone was a wonderful child of God. You're talking about somebody cutting you off in traffic. That's what I would say about them. I started to say this so much, my kids made fun of me. They called me Mr. Octopus. They couldn't pronounce optimism, so they called me Mr. Octopus. So life was going well. I moved back in. Eventually, we moved. I took another job, but I started to slack off on my program. There were no SA meetings where we had moved, so I started an SA meeting. I was so proud of myself. And then no one came. I blamed God for not sending me any sexaholics. I told you I was crazy. And I wasn't doing the maintenance on my spiritual condition. So I got a great idea. I'll just open the door a little to lust. You know, not the serious stuff. You know, just a little light pornography on TV. And it went horribly wrong. Because I can't handle any lust. So my wife found out and threw me out of the house all over again. I felt so stupid. Everything I knew, all the recovery I had done, and I still threw it away for lust. It's pretty incredible. So I had to humble myself again, find a new sponsor, work the steps all over again. Then we moved out here. I arrived first for a new job. My family stayed on the East Coast. Money was tight. My wife was looking for a job. We couldn't sell our house. And I was living alone in a Holiday Inn for 4 months. Not an ideal situation for a sexaholic. I started to think, I'm not sure my higher power can really handle this. This is a lot. Maybe lust would help me feel a little better. But then I found a bunch of people in this room at the Pasadena Sunday night meeting. They took me in with open arms. I needed that community and fellowship. They were my anchor in stormy seas, and I can never thank them enough. When I first got to SA, I hated the idea of going to these meetings for the rest of my life. Now I realize it is the best part of my life. something that brings me happiness and joy. My best friends are all sexaholics. And I have to keep coming back because I'm never going to be cured. I believe this disease still wants to kill me. It could be slow. It could be fast. It's waiting for me right outside this room, waiting to pounce at any opportunity it sees. For me, this is life or death. I have one final reflection. My father died in December after a long illness, and my mother passed away a few years before that. I miss them both, and it's difficult to even contemplate life without them in it. It leaves a void that's like, it's very hard to describe. But thanks to this program, I was able to make amends to both of them. And for many years, I was able to be with them sober and be truly present and be of service to them. And that is an absolute gift from this program and my higher power. So I want to thank you again for letting me share, and I'm very grateful for your time. Thanks.